All right, guys, welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. I've got Bill Hemmer here today. Bill, I'm going to start with this.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I want to punch you in the gut or pat you on the back for getting the opportunity to go with the Navy, the Silent Service, to the Arctic Circle. I checked my inbox. No correspondence from the Navy. So, hey, congrats, man. That's
thank you.
How many people?
I was grateful to get the opportunity, first of all. Because I know how rare it is, especially in that part of the world. How many people? 150, all men. All with something to do at every moment of every hour of the day. Doing their job. If they weren't doing their job, they were sleeping, they were reading, or they're just having a casual conversation.
And how long are they there for?
You can be underway for 3 months at a time, and it's a nuclear sub. So if you got enough to eat, you never have to come home.
Okay, we're going to dive into that because I do have a deep respect for what we call the silent service, which is our submariners. I've got a lot of friends that are submariners doing great things in the business world. They are a different breed. By nature, they have to be. But so you have one of the most recognizable faces globally as a newscaster. People see you and they're like, oh, Bill Hemmer. They know who you are. Rarely do people know the stories of a lot of the key personalities in news. So I want to dive in to sort of your life story, give the people a sense of who you are, where you come from. And then I've been told to ask about this backpacking trip.
Oh,
you're like, you gotta ask Bill. I'm like, okay, I'll ask Bill.
That was the greatest adventure.
How old?
That was 26. I mean, that changed my life in so many ways.
Let's get to that. Let's start born and raised.
You got it. You leave.
Yeah. So, you know, born and raised, where are you from?
Cincinnati, Ohio. Born at Good Samaritan Hospital, fifth floor. I say that because I was just there last weekend helping my mom get her home. So, you know, we've come full circle. Not quite, but close to it. And went to an all-boy Catholic high school in Cincinnati. And then I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And during that time in college, we had the only school in the country of Luxembourg. All right. Miami of Ohio,
had a sister
Oxford,
school.
Ohio, had the only school in the entire country of Luxembourg at the time. This is 1986. So I did 6 months there. I just got really into like all the travel and the learning experience. And I could tell you a billion stories about it. But I was really into it. And so got a job as a sports producer coming out of college, $9,000 a year, Cincinnati, Ohio. Got a raise of $12,000 2 years later. I was moving, man. And finally got my dream job, which was a sports reporter in my hometown. So, you know, it was great. You know, I'm traveling with the Cincinnati Bengals. They're my team. I'm in the locker room with Pete Rose and the Cincinnati Reds. They're my team. And I tell you, Mike, I flatlined. You know, I got really bored really fast.
Interesting.
And I thought, wow, I gotta find something, you know, because I always knew that if you challenge your brain, you will never lose interest in what you're doing. And maybe that's a curiosity aspect, it's an intellectual aspect, it's something to keep you thinking about life and all the aspects that we find in life. So I was like, Billy, you know, you're going to be 30. You know, the walls of my world were closing in, and I said, I really got to do this thing. So I took the 15 grand I had in the bank, and I quit, and I backpacked around the world for a year. And this was not Paris. It was not Belgium. This was not London. This was China before it was like a competing market with the United States. This was Vietnam when it was still considered third world. This was India. It was Nepal. It was Indonesia. It was Eastern Europe. It was the Middle East. It was Russia. And I just, you know, Mike, I just did something new every day and never forgot it. Came home and just saw the world in a different light. And
I've always said the I'm trying to instill this in my 16-year-old son, had an opportunity this summer to go to the UK. I said, hey, do you want to go? I'll pay for the trip. No, I'm good. I'm like, hey, the best education in the world is travel.
That's right.
100%.
Yeah. Well, reading books too is really good.
Leadership through leadership.
But I just think travel is it because you experience it, you know, in a very visceral way.
Especially when you go to Nepal. Nepal was one of the most spiritual experiences for me. again, that's how I think a lot of Americans lack perspective, because they usually go to the Parises, the Romes. Yeah. They don't go
Which
to
is
Nepal.
Great. Don't yes. get me wrong. Hey, it's beautiful. Good stuff.
But they don't go to Vietnam. They don't go to India. They don't see how the other world lives yeah. in what true gratitude looks like.
Yeah. My best lesson, Mike, is before I did all that, I wanted to know how I would react. So I took a trip to Guatemala and Belize, and I went there on my own, and it was great. You know, you see the great Tikal, you know, kingdom and northeastern jungle of Guatemala, and you're, you know, diving the great reef of off the coast of Belize. It's beautiful, but it's also third world, you know? And I think I went, took it in for 10 days, went home and said, all right, Billy, that's the way it is. Are you cool with it? And I was like all in. And so that really helped me. And so what I talk to, like a lot of young people, when they have questions about whether or not they want to make this experience, I just give them a little bit of that. You know, go ahead, just dip your toe in, come out of it, learn it, accept it, and then know that you can, there's an opportunity to do a lot of this.
So it's safe to say you hit a career sort of, you know, precipice in terms of passion, and you decided to go on a expedition of yeah. sorts to sort of determine your next step.
Yes.
And I'm assuming when you came out of that, you said, I want to get into reporting on world news.
So when I left, my boss said, we want you to come back and work for us. I said, great, because I might get malaria in 4 months and I might be back looking for a gig anyway. And I said, I'll come back and work for you, but I want to be in news. And so I did that for a couple of years, and really tedious work. You know, you're the low man on the totem pole. You're getting the worst assignment of the day every day at 8 a.m. But what I learned, Mike, is that you get to understand your community, your city, your county, your state, start to see how things work. The court system, politics, school levies, gas levies, you name it. And it's a necessary foundation of knowledge that everyone must have in order to understand the community in which they live. So here now, I've got this trip. I've got a little bit of news. And I went down to CNN in Atlanta and auditioned for this job, and I got the gig.
And how old are you?
I was 30. And, you know, what they do is they do this big audition where they pull a teleprompter out and they give you breaking news. They want to see how you react and interview people on the fly. And, you know, I have a sports background. So in sports, what happens is your brain learns how to look at images on a screen and figures out how to spit the words out of your mouth, which, by the way, is cable news defined. That's what we do every day. So between the sports and the travel and the news, and it just all came together. And Bob Fernand was his name, and I walked into his office. Well, this is what I knew. I knew the only thing I knew about him, I didn't know what he looked like. This, you know, this before you could just Google his image, right? I just knew that he doesn't meet with you until he sees you audition.
If he wants to meet with you.
Correct.
If the audition went well.
And so, boom, 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 boom. We got this plane down in St. Louis. You're going to interview the head of TWA. I'm the spokesperson of TWA. Boom, boom, boom. And I said, you know, we do this whole thing. Look, I was a freak for cable. I'm a child of cable news. I mean, I watched the Oliver North hearings in 1987.
I remember those.
Okay.
Yes. Right?
So I was into the drama that cable news provided. And we're doing this interview, and he said, I got a plane down short of the runway in St. Louis. Interview me. Boom, boom, boom. Sorry, Bob. I'm on. It's Bob Smith, TWA, doing these questions. I said, by the way, what's short of the runway? And because I'm thinking, is that a neighborhood? Is it a field? And because if it's neighbor, if it's day, we got real problems here. So he brings me in his office. He goes, man, I know you're 30, but you look 18. And there's only one way for me to sell you to my boss. And he turns over my resume. He goes, write down every country you've ever been to. And I got the 30, I got the 40, I got the 50. I said, I can keep going. He said, no, that's good enough. Because that's the only way I'm going to sell you to my guy. And I walked out the door. He goes, I'll be in touch. But by the way, no one's ever asked me what's short of the runway. And so I thought, I might be on to something.
What questions to ask?
That was 28 years ago.
The power of knowing what, the quality of the questions you ask yeah. to pull context is, is phenomenal.
Yes. I appreciate, thank you. Thank you for saying that. To ask good questions, you need to spend quiet time reading and figuring out what's the best way to phrase it. So not only you understand it, not only you understand it, but the people at home are understand at the same time too.
So it seems like it's safe to say, I'll give you an analogy. CNN is almost like the McKinsey, like the pedigree of people that came out of CNN. Uh-huh. Because CNN was started in
1980. Yeah.
1980.
Yeah, Ted Turner.
Okay.
June 1st.
But why in my head is it that CNN hit prominence with the first Gulf War?
Well, because that was the only broadcast available. They had a video feed from ABC, and they had three correspondents in the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. So they could match the audio to the video. And boom, you had global television magic.
But CNN just had the bullpen of all stars back in the day.
It was the only shop in town.
Yeah. So it was that competitive, to almost like the Harvard of...
To get a job there?
Yeah.
I thought so. I mean, for me, it was the only game in town. They covered national and international news. They covered all the major events. Amanpour is over there in Yugoslavia for 3 years. I'm like, full respect for that. No one else did it until Fox came along in 1996 and MSNBC came along in 1996. Mm-hmm. They were both launched at the same time. And everybody had their money in MSNBC. Why? Because they had Microsoft money and General Electric money. That's pretty good, right? And Fox had Rupert and Roger Ailes. And if your money was on MSNBC, you lost.
When did you switch over to Fox?
2005. Yeah.
God, you know, I've been
by
on
the way,
line.
My Go time ahead. At CNN was amazing.
Oh, I have no doubt. Education.
I had the opportunity to see history globally change for the lives of millions and millions of people before my eyes. I was kind of like, I was living what I wanted to do. And 18 years at Fox now, and it hasn't stopped. And I just feel very grateful for it. Not to jump the gun on the timeline.
No. I'll tell you what, I won't name names. I've been to a lot of news networks, and I'm good friends with Gavin.
Sure.
So yeah. There's nothing like coming to Fox News. You guys are all just kind and respectful and empathetic. Walking into Fox is a different experience than walking into any other news outlet.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I think everybody's got everybody's back here, and you know, it's a much different environment than a lot of the other cutthroat operations and environments have.
Let me ask you this. You know, you are a student of the world. And I know there's a big debate with news of the job of a news reporter is to report the news, not weigh in with opinions. You have different parties that what is your view on your job as one of the world's foremost news hosts? I mean, what do you think, there's a line on reporting and weighing in with opinion?
I do, yes. I think I go right up to it without crossing it. But I also think the profession's changed, and I don't think the audience is stupid.
No.
And I think people know it, and they've accepted it. But whether I've got a Republican senator on the air, or whether I have the spokesperson from the Pentagon or John Kirby yesterday, and it's my job to figure out what the important questions are. And I hope I do that, generally speaking, fairly well on a daily basis. That's on me. And if I miss something, it bothers me, because I just want to make sure that I've seen the whole picture. And a lot of times a guest will choose to answer questions in a forthright way, and other times they're going to bob and weave. And I think the bobbing and weaving probably tells us just as much as the forthright question. Straightforward answer, I should say.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not one to throw compliments where they're not deserved. You do it in a very unemotional, professional way. Regardless, you know, you can't tell where your opinion weighs in.
I appreciate that.
You guys are very respectful with your guests across the board. It's just amazing how, I think this is an accurate statement. Media is the most powerful entity on this planet. And with that comes a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we just did the, I know we're going to talk about this Arctic thing in a second here.
Yeah.
But we aired a piece a couple of weeks ago and we're watching it, Mike, right? You know, we're in the edit booth and we're going, oh, I don't know. Do we need five more frames of that? There's 30 frames in a second. That's how TV works. So you can hit a dissolve. It's usually a 15 frame dissolve. So it's essentially half a second, right? So it's like, no, make it 10 or make it 20. Oh, no, I need 25. That's a long dissolve. No, and we're like just piecing this thing together and boom, 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 boom. And you lose perspective because you're looking at this thing like you're looking at that little silver box over there. And we lose like the experience that the viewer is ultimately going to have. And I say, Lissa was my producer. She's terrific. And, we're going back and forth on this. I said, it's going to play differently on that than it is over there. And it always does. And so your statement, I think, is absolutely right. It is I know people talk about cord cutters in the cable news world. I know people talk about streamers and watching it on your phone or your iPad or whatever the viewing devices of your choice, but that thing is still has remarkable power. Mm. And what we do here is, we have what it's called a quad box. So we got Fox, we got Fox Business, we got CNN, we got MSNBC. And Mike, if you sit back and you watch that sucker, I mean, to me, I don't know if other people feel the same way that I do, but when I get mesmerized by, the choice of words on the screen. We call banners on the bottom third. The graphics they use. The graphics we use, what the competition does, the images you use, it is really a powerful thing. And when used responsibly, it's a good thing.
100%. Let me ask this. I mean, the schedules you guys maintain is pretty insane. With that, are you reading all the time?
All the time.
Are you reading or are you watching?
Both.
Both.
That's not a great answer, but it's true.
Is that the hallmark of truly great reporters?
I think my feeling is that I never want to have a producer get in my ear and tell me something that I don't already know. And if I get close to that, I'm gonna have a shot. And what I told my colleagues, I don't know if we're talking about it, if somebody wants advice or they want to talk about how do you handle this or how you do that. My thing is you always want to have an extra question in your back pocket because you don't know. And you don't know when they're going to stop talking. You don't know how gracious they're going to be towards you in their answers or how short they can be. And You don't find yourself stuck, because if you get stuck, the audience notices, and you don't want to be in that situation.
And watching you guys is more art than I think science. It's years of
Mike,
cutting your sword.
I tell the team, if it were science, we just put 2 + 2 and we just come back the next day and do it again that way.
Good. So we're gonna get into the Arctic Circle. Which when is this released on Fox Nation?
It drops on standby. April 17th.
Okay, tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get this out.
Isn't it amazing how you can't remember the date?
I think for high performing professionals, it doesn't really matter. You just keep on going.
Maybe. I think it's all because of the digital phone.
The digital phone.
Yeah. Because you're not writing things on a calendar anymore. It's all right here. I mean, you just saw what I did, right?
Yeah.
17th.
I've got a notebook on me at all times. I mean, well, one, a lot of brain trauma from the old job, but it's a compensatory measure.
Get it.
But no, I'm with you there. All right. First off, how did this opportunity come your way? Did the Navy contact Fox and say, we want Bill Hemmer?
Yeah. The PAO, for Admiral Darrell Caudle is a guy by the name of Dave Hecht, and he went to my high school. So he called me in November. He said, Bill, every 2 years we do this thing. Are you interested? I said, I didn't hang up the phone. I was like, you bet. So when do we go? And he says, it's going to be in March. Dates are a little bit in flex, but I want to see if you're interested. You'd be embedded for with us, call it 3 days. And this is basically the format, you know. Well,
that was a three-day trip?
72 hours.
You're kidding me.
Oh.
All right, so you go up to D.C., is that correct?
Yes.
Get so on the Admiral's private jet.
So we had Super Tuesday on Tuesday.
Yes.
We turn and burn. You're on 3 hours of sleep into Wednesday morning. Nikki Haley announces she's dropping out. We cover that. We jump a plane down to D.C., bed down for the night, up at 5. Go to Joint Base Andrews and meet Admiral Caudle and the Vice Admiral of the Canadian Navy. A great guy. And then about 9 others, and boarded a plane, and off we flew.
What were your initial impressions of Admiral Caudle?
Amazing guy. Really straightforward. Have you met him?
No. But most our flag and general officers are sharp,
okay,
for the most part.
This guy is sharp.
Yeah.
He knows what he wants to say. He knows what he wants to do. He has a firm worldview, and I appreciate that.
First stop is Dead Horse.
Yeah, ever heard of it?
I don't know, but the name would throw me off. What's Dead Horse? What's the backstory there?
It is, first of all, you're on a plane for 7 hours and 40 minutes. And once you get up into the Great Lakes and you're up in Canada and you're flying all the way across the Northwest Territory and all the way across the Yukon Territory and into the northern shore of Alaska, Mike, all you have seen is ice and snow for 7 freaking hours. And we're coming in and, you know, there's 10,000 foot mountains to your left. And then there apparently is the Arctic Ocean there, but you can't tell where the ocean ends and the land begins. And there is I guess it was an oil refinery, but I don't know. Don't quote me on it. Some sort of, you know, energy producers that were operating. It was the only physical structures you could see. And you look out that window and you think, turn this plane around. Because nothing lives down there. And so we land. Keep in mind, we've only seen ice and snow for 7 hours. And they tell you it melts in the summertime. And there's no way for a civilian, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a sailor, and there's no way for me to understand how in the world does all this melt. And they say, oh yeah, it will. You know, eventually, like late summer, September, you want to be here with an icebreaker. And okay, all right. But we're here now. We put on our Arctic gear. We're in a big warehouse, all right, the Navy has set up. We take a sea otter, and we fly an hour and a half north into the Arctic Ocean over the Beaufort Sea, and we softest landing ever. Just hit that ice and snow. I mean, you barely tell, like a pillow. And we land, and we get out, and, man, it's 40 below zero.
So having seen the documentary, you can see your breath on the what was the platform, a C-130 or
that was a sea otter. I think
sea otter. Okay,
maybe held 20. Maybe
no heat at the time when it starts up. I mean,
no.
You guys look
earplugs,
there.
Loud,
unpressurized. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's an insane ride. I mean, I'll put it to you this way: you're going into man country. That is what we refer to as man town.
I dig it. Thank you.
Yeah.
I will take the compliment. Mike, we're looking out the window the entire time. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
Nothing. Then you see these little yellow specks on the horizon. Tiny things. And there was like 9 tents that were set up on this ice floe that was moving 0.8 miles an hour.
Yes.
Which I think is slow, frankly. I think the later you get into the summertime, the more the ice floe starts to move. And you land, and, you know, you get your bearings, you get the briefing, and you got a mess hall, which serves as a meeting hall. That's one tent. You got a science tent where they drill into the ice, and they check water temperature, ice thickness, how sound travels, depending on whether the ice is thicker or thinner, which I think is probably really good for sonar.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't say that, but mm-hmm. I think so. They want to study the environment to see how it's going to change in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. Which has been undecided, but everybody's got their opinion about it. And they've got an HQ where they're communicating with nuclear submarines that are beneath the ice. And then they got these nine tents. Eight of them you sleep in, and the ninth one's a latrine. And I'll spare you the details, but you know, I spent a ton of time there.
You're not staying at the Ritz, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the MI, when I was in my first military experience with respect to you and what you have done was December of 2001. So we're just a couple months in, and it was at the airport in Kandahar, and I was with CNN. I was there a month, and I never served in the military. But I got to meet U.S. Marines, 2300, it was MEU, Marine Expeditionary Unit, the best of the Rangers, the best of the SEALs, best of the FBI, the best of the CIA that the country had at the time. And I got to meet them as fathers and sons and brothers and uncles and mothers and aunts. And my impression of the military changed immediately. And that was a pretty, if you want to indulge in the military and dive right in, I can't think of a better experience. And I was born in 1964. So we had the shadow of Vietnam throughout my entire generation, right?
Yes.
And then we get into Somalia. Doesn't go well. We pull the ripcord, and then we fight a war from 15,000 feet over Yugoslavia in 1999. And so, you know, we're real. We are truly a risk-averse country when 9/11 happens. But the men and women of the military knew at the time that we needed to overcome that. And how we did that would happen, but it would take a little bit of time. So that experience at the airport in Kandahar with James Mad Dog Mattis and his happy band of thieves was really made an impression on me.
As you said, you're coming off of the tail end of Vietnam. And I think what a lot of Americans' sort of perceptions of the military are based off of Oliver Stone's Platoon. And that doesn't paint the military in a great light. And
neither did some of the other films.
Exactly.
Or some of the other reporting.
I think you get into the more modern or contemporary genre of Masters of the Air and Band of Brothers, it really does paint the intellectual horsepower of the guys over there. I mean, you've got guys that were going to law school. I mean, some of the smartest people I met were in the SEAL teams and graduating out of Colgate and just decided to go into the SEAL teams. I mean, English major, just articulate, very bright. But I'm glad, I mean, the fact that you were in Kandahar in December of 2001, which is basically a month and a half after the, you know, horse soldiers inserted.
Yeah, yes, correct. Yeah.
That's pretty historic. I'm sort of jealous because I was having to hear those stories from the guys coming back.
Uh-huh.
Jealous as hell. I mean, how long were you in Kandahar for?
About a month. You know, they were setting everything up.
Yeah.
We were so risk averse, Mike, that the U.S. Air Force was not allowed to land on an airstrip and Kandahar, Afghanistan, during daylight hours. How bonkers was that?
Yeah.
You could only land at night, so all the C-17s would fly in at night, and their big jet engines would swirl around on the tarmac, and all of our windows were blown out because we slept in the terminal, and we had, like, plastic sheets up, you know, with tape on them. And, you know, you wake up in the morning, and all that fine Afghan dust that I know you're aware of, you know, it's really an interesting dust. You know, it's not grainy.
Moon dust.
Yeah, literally you can blow on it and it just goes right off the top of your computer and disappears. And you wake up and it's covered in your sleeping bag. You get up, you shake it off, and you go about your day again. And we travel there with this massive truck. And we had all of our equipment on board. And it took half a day to have that thing searched to get on base. And we'd set up all of our stuff, and we'd send a message back to Atlanta, top line, whatever our system is in iNews that we're using. And we walk away, make a cup of coffee, come back 8 minutes later, get the response, send another note, walk away, throw another piece of wood on the fire, come back, get another message. When we were just at the Arctic Ocean, 220 miles north of the north coast of Alaska, we flew in to a tent city, it's It's not a city. It's a village. No, it's not. It's not a village. It's a encampment set up by the U.S. Navy. When we land, our phones have text, email, the ability to make phone calls on a Starlink system set up by Elon Musk that the Navy's running. And our photographer, Frank Marola, who served in the U.S. Army, so he's fought wars and he's covered wars. Mm. And Jimmy Studdeth, who's our audio guy from the White House, who covers every major news event around the world. So these guys are the real deal. And I'm 28 years burning down the road now, and so I've seen a few things. But none of us had ever experienced this before. And we have instant communications. We are almost 75 degrees north latitude. And we're doing live shots for the Fox News Channel and Fox Weather.
I didn't know that.
How about that? I think it might be the most northern live shot that's ever been conducted. So I'm kind of into that stuff.
We're going to have to contact Guinness.
Yeah, never know. Right.
I was going to ask if you went through cell phone withdrawals, because when we were in Antarctica, Starlink wasn't set up. Uh-huh. There's no coverage over gotcha. Antarctica. So we had zero comms. Guys kept checking their cell phones. You'd catch them looking at their cell phones, which
there's
is
nothing there.
So when I was watching the film, you step off the plane and your face is red.
Mm-hmm.
Because what was the temp?
It was minus 40. Maybe it got to minus 20 without the wind. No warmer than minus 20.
That's cold.
But easily could drop to minus 40 or minus 50 in a minute.
Wind chill. Yeah. Always is what gets you.
They tell you when you see the skin of another person turn white, you need to tell them to get inside. And it's usually on the nose because your mouth is covered and you're inhaling through your nose.
What was your overall impression of the sailors running that encampment? And sometimes guys get a little off when you're so isolated for so long.
Yeah. Amazing. I thought it was interesting that they left no trace. And I've been to Burning Man one time, and I'll never go back. It was a horrible experience for many reasons. And there's the thing there called leave no trace. So you can't, everything you bring, you got to bring out. That's what the Navy was doing. I said to Cottle, Admiral Cottle, I said, why are you guys doing this? He goes, well, Bill, we have a lot of people to keep happy. I said, well, who initiated this? He goes, I did. I said, well, whoops, sorry. I said, when? He said, 2018. You know, we have a lot of jurisdictions who look over mm-hmm. us, and they had a lawyer mm-hmm. from the EPA with them. You know, there's only 62 sailors and scientists there. One of them was a lawyer to make sure they're doing everything right. And when I say you have to take everything out, you have to take everything out, including that which is found in the ninth tent, which is the
latrine. That negative 40. I recently had Les Stroud. If you know who Les Stroud is, Survivor Man. Yeah. I asked him what was the most challenging environment, tundra, jungle. He said, "I don't care about the environment." He said, "It's cold. Cold is the one thing that you cannot combat if you're not resourced for it." He's like, "It is the number one killer."
So that night we slept in these tents. They're literally called the Arctic Tent. The logo on the tent says Arctic Tent. They're yellow. You know, Mike, I mean, good try. I mean, we slept in all of our clothes. Our boots were inside. Two sleeping bags pulled over the top
of our
head.
So no heating system.
Well, I mean, there was a heating system. It ran on a combination. It was like a hybrid, like electricity. It had a charge and it had some fuel. And they were pumping heat in. But I if it got 10 inches away from the...
So we're not going green up there. I'm kidding.
Right. Correct. Yeah. You wake up every hour. You're freezing. Yeah. You really don't want to have to hit the latrine at that point.
Well, I was going to ask, did you
no,
hold it?
I held it.
Yeah.
And I think I got crashed for about 4 hours. I wake up, and Frankie's already editing stuff. I'm like, Frankie, what's up? He goes, I just can't sleep. And so the day goes on, and I was waiting for the sub. And, sorry. And Frankie says, get it over with. You'll feel better. I said, all right. That's what we'll do.
Well, but first off,
Starlink, okay?
Yeah.
I tell these guys, I say, you know, I don't own a Tesla, but I'd like to, but I have no use for it because I live in New York City. I don't use PayPal. I use Venmo. I love SpaceX. I love to watch it, but I've never been on a rocket before. But this applies to our lives and our jobs that we do. Now, so, fellas, we can now go live anywhere in the world because of this device that we can carry in a suitcase. To me, that's a mind blower.
I remember something. We were still using HF communications in the military and the Marines in 1998 through 2000. before we moved to satellite communications. So you're playing with the wires, you're doing poises is what they're called to amplify. It was awful. But now, I mean, if you saw what I was wearing towards the end of the global war on terrors, I had SATCOM right on my back, which you get communications out easy. Right. I mean, everything has changed for the better. Now, a World War III, that probably, I mean, the first thing that goes is everyone's going to go for your GPS and communication satellites. And that's just sort of the point.
My feeling is the country that can defend its satellites wins.
Of course. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. So you take a helicopter ride.
Yep. Chopper north.
To the middle of nowhere, which you're already in the middle of nowhere. You go further north. Watching that thing pop out of the ice.
Yeah.
Must have been.
It's pretty cool.
Can you, I mean, hear it? Is it, you hear it cracking through the ice?
You do. It's not as dramatic sound wise as you would expect. But Mike, we had been on that ice sheet for 4 hours and they had a little tent set up. Everyone was frozen and it was time. But when the thing comes up, they're looking for 3 feet of ice, 7,000 ton vessel. They went 3 feet of ice to make it easy to break through. Frankly, I think they probably could have broken through 10 feet of ice, and no less than 2 feet because they want to be able to stabilize the vessel in the ice there. And
yes.
Then they cut through the hatch, and I'm sure you saw
it. I saw that. That was interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, with chainsaws. And, you know, it's 2 to 3 feet thick, and there's no water. There was a little water over by the side of the sail, and it was pushed up, but it freezes instantly. And you know, you get the hatch open and on board you climb.
Do you have a problem with confined spaces?
I didn't know. It crossed my mind.
I mean, you put me in an MRI machine now. I'm like, hey, yep, get me out. I'm done.
Oh, right.
I hate confined spaces.
Half a Xanax will help you with that. Trust me. Or some good music. I didn't know. What Caudill taught me was that there's always a commodity of space. He says, you think you live your life like this, but then it starts like this, then live like this, but you realize you only need this much. And what I learned on board that sub is that everything had a purpose. You know, in the torpedo room, underneath the torpedo room, there are beds where there are bunks where people sleep. You know, if you're in your berth, right, you see a hook, you're like, oh, I see. That's there, well, because of this. There is like a lockbox under, you know, I say it's 18 inches, maybe it's 20. I don't know the height of the sleeping bed. I think it's 18.
When you got in, you had a little trouble turning around.
A little bit. Yeah. I asked them not to use that one. I kid. There's a box in there with a lock. So you have personal valuables, right? Makes sense. That bed flips up. There's 4 inches of space under there.
Yes.
You can fold all your clothes in there. So my point is, commodity of space, everything has a purpose.
Overall, what was your impression of the sailors? Because the silent service, I mean, you're talking about strategic assets, which all enemies try to track each other's subs, but those are a pivotal factor in our strike capability if required. But, I mean, these guys have a very important mission. They're very unique. What was your opinion of the professionalism, the camaraderie, because they're in a tight space? And how many on the sub?
150. All men, not integrated.
In a football field length.
In a football field, 110 yards, you're right. A couple things on that. Stop me if I'm going too long.
And these guys look young too.
Yeah, they do. Most of them. You're right. When they go underwater, they have no contact with the world. iPhones don't work. There is no Facebook. There's no Instagram. There's no surfing the web. You don't watch TV. So you're either working, or you're sleeping, or you're reading a book, you're having a conversation between each other. It's old school. That really left an impression on me. The commanding officer sat down, did an interview with him. And I said, so we're dropping away from this ice. And you're leaving the world behind. And you're underway. And your ability to communicate is severely limited. You can do it, but they don't do it a lot. You can receive messages, but you can't really transmit a lot because you don't want to give yourself away. I said, what's that feeling like? He said, freedom. I said,
I thought you were going to say that.
And I said, well, why are you in the Navy? Why in the submarine? He said, my grandfather was and my father was. And I learned that, you know, a lot of guys, you know, that family lineage is that way. And the other half is, you know, take this the right way, but they will tell you my life was a mess. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I walked into a recruiting office and I signed up for the Navy and I found a family and my life was put back together. And I mean, they're polar opposites, but those are the men that I met on board the USS Hampton.
You couldn't have paraphrased that better. You couldn't have summarized that better. And it is a family. And a lot of times, some of these guys are married, they have kids. I hate to say it, it sounds awful, forthright, but my first family was my guys. My wife and my kids were my second family. Because there was a duty to one another to be able to execute your roles and responsibilities. You had to go all in. And that's a major sacrifice that the people of America just don't know, is that the military consumed your life, but gives you a sense of purpose. And I'll say it, the Marine Corps sent me back to school to become an officer while being paid. Then they sent me to go get my MBA. These guys are bright. And just because somebody lacked focus or maybe just didn't have the right role models at 16, 17, 18, you put them through that the greatest onboarding program in the world for 3 months straight. It's called boot camp, regardless of whatever service you go to. And they come out completely different, understanding the honor, courage, commitment, the discipline and accountability that come with that role. But it is concerning, and I understand why recruitment is down. But I think a lot of young men and women just don't understand the amount of doors that the military opens up to you.
Yeah.
And I owe a good part to my parents, great folks. But the military gave me a lot in life, and I wish I can never...
Yeah, full respect for that. I saw that at 350 feet below, but I learned it in 2001.
Yes. So I want to get your perspective, because you're with Admiral Cottle. People think the Arctic, which is becoming a new battleground. So the strategic nature of this area, the conflict between, if we can call it a conflict between, or let's say the race between Russia and the NATO countries. I think you said it. There's 9 countries that have 8, and 7 of them belong to NATO. But Russia is very serious about dominance over the Arctic.
Yeah.
Because, and again, I'll let you get into it, because if the ice melts, new trade routes open up for oil and everything else.
Yeah, and in the summertime, some of those trade routes are already open. What Cottle's big concern was that Russia's going to charge you for transit. And I guess it's possible. and when, if our lifetimes, the next lifetime, if you can transit across, you know, the North Pole, you can save a lot of days, you know, shipping wise. But even then, I don't want to give you the impression that this is going to be the Mediterranean Sea, because you're going to have. You're going to need giant icebreakers to go with you. I think we have 2 Coast Guard. I think the Russians have 37. Some of them are nuclear.
I didn't know that.
They're ready for
this.
That's
interesting.
Yeah, and if you looked at the top of the world, Arctic Circle, right, carve it out, you know, you've got Greenland, good portion, owned by Denmark. You got the northern quarter of Norway, a little bit of Finland, a little bit of Sweden, a ton of Russia. And I think 80% of his profits from natural gas come from areas that they farm north of the Arctic Circle. So there's a supply there.
Mineral rich.
Yeah. Depending on how you can get it economically to market is another question. But NASA believes we're losing 12% ice every year. The scientists I talk to think that's aggressive. The White House believes you'll go from white Arctic to blue Arctic by the year 2030. What does that mean? Frozen ice and snow to an ocean. Now, the scientists I talk to say that's too aggressive too. They say maybe the 1940s, that was the answer I was given. Sorry, 2040s, excuse me. We have seen other estimates on this, and some of them have been off. And what a lot of the scientific work they're doing up there right now is trying to make their best guess. They believe there are copious amounts of oil and natural gas and rare earth materials beneath that ice. But how do you get to it? And are you going to set a derrick up in the 70 miles north of Dead Horse, Alaska? And does that survive in 70 degrees during the summertime and 70 below during the winter? And even if it does, how are you pulling the product out? Mm-hmm. And what's it cost in the end? I mean, all these things need to be factored in. The other thing is China. China is not one of these eight countries. And in 2018, China declared itself a near Arctic nation. I don't know how you do that. I don't know if any other country in the world recognized that, except for maybe Norway, because the Chinese hooked up with the Norwegians, and they went to an island well north of the Arctic Circle, Svalbard. They used to be called Spitsbergen until recently. And they set up a science lab up there. So the Chinese are doing this right now because you know what they're all about. They're all about, you know, the African rare earths, et cetera. So there is a competition that is already underway. Who wins that competition, who's best established for that, is the reason why people like Admiral Cottle wants to bring Fox News along so that we can tell the rest of the world, and chiefly not just our military leaders, but our political leaders.
I think it's akin to Iran claimed part of Antarctica recently. I don't know if you caught that.
I did not.
They did. So dubious claims, to say the least.
Right. Check that out.
Overall,
yeah,
one of the top experiences.
Really great. Don't know if I do it again tomorrow. My big toe's still coming back. Boots weren't great. 3 inches of rubber, it's pretty good. Keeps you off the ice.
But yes.
Beyond that, not much help.
Yeah.
Frankie and Jimmy and I, as I said, we've done a lot, but that was every hour of every day we're doing something different that we'd never had done before prior to that experience.
And Fox Nation is doing a lot of great programming like this that you're not going to find anywhere else.
Well, I hope you find it that way because it was a blast to do it. It was a blast to put it together. And if they need me to go back, I shall. But I'm good for now.
Okay. That's fair. Well, I mean, you didn't get to see any polar bears.
No.
You got to get up close at least once. Maybe up close is relative.
You know, they were looking for polar bears in the scans that they were watching.
I can only imagine.
And they're looking for cracked ice, too, because a couple years ago, I guess they had a small crack.
Somebody went through it.
Some tents or something. No people. So we were good.
So I've got to assume they're armed up there, a couple.
Yes.
Polar bears. Yeah.
Yes.
Bear mace does not work too well on.
They have a lot of that bear mace. Yeah. Very good. Very good, Mike. And they've got some flares that you can fire too. And then if worse comes to worse,
yeah,
you do what you do.
Well, Bill, I am jealous. I watched the special is good, especially for, again, most Americans don't consider the Arctic. It's not a region we focus on. It was educational. And I can only imagine you got a masterclass being around.
Yeah.
The silent service and Admiral Cottle of how strategically important the Arctic Circle is. Maybe not right now, but 10, 20 years.
But now's when you put down the roots, and now's when you get ready for that. Yeah. You know, you prepare for war in a time of peace. And one thing I did not know, Mike, is that the best food in the entire U.S. military is on board a submarine.
They deserve it. You got to give them something.
And they do it for morale.
Of course.
And it's really good.
Of course.
So I thank the Navy for giving us the opportunity to have a bit of their experience that we can share with others.
Amazing. I appreciate you doing what you do, especially highlighting the veterans. Not every network does that the way you guys do. Fox has always been very supportive of the U.S. military, and that's just dear to my heart.
We thank Frank Siller for that now.
Yes.
Tunnel to Towers.
Yes. Amazing organization.
Folds of Honor.
Both amazing organizations. What do you got coming up? What are just some projects to share for the listeners to keep their eyes on?
We've got this. We've got
smiling right now. So
no, we're working on this thing. It's dropped this week too, about the relationship between Russia and China, because this is something we need to pay attention to. You know, my feeling is, could we have prevented the Ukraine war? Could we have done that? And if we did, we would have not forced governments around the world to pick a team. But that's not reality now because the world's divided in two, And there are alliances that are going to be favorable to the United States, and there are alliances that are not.
Mm.
And I think it's very unfortunate, but that's the world in which we live in today. And I would just say, you know, just keep an eye on it and see how these relationships develop.
I think that's a whole other podcast. We could dive deep.
Done.
I do have my own opinions. But so is that also coming out on Fox Nation?
It's called The New Axis of Evil.
Mm.
And it links Iran with Russia and Iran with China. And we know that relationship is already deep.
And I was just on this morning, Fox and Friends, you know, Iran can't do anything meaningful without Russia mm-hmm. or China. And
that's right.
That's their last card to play. But I've got to say as well, if you guys, Fox Nation is worth, and I'm not just saying this, it's worth the streaming fee, especially the specials that you guys have dropped on who's Netanyahu, who's Al-Khamenei, Hamas. They've got a whole series of separate documentaries on everything surrounding the Israel-Hamas-Iranian conflict.
Thank you for saying that. And a lot of it's easy watching, too, because it's 25 minutes. It's 37 minutes. You can consume it, and you don't have to sit there all day.
No books coming out?
No.
Working on something?
Not yet. Not yet. Maybe what's short of the runway should be the direction.
Love it. Bill, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Cool. I know your schedule is hectic. Again, congrats on the Arte.
Thank you, Mike.
On just an amazing life story. And good to always meet the people that I watch on a daily basis.
Cool. Pleasure.
So, thanks, man. Right on. All right, guys.
And thank you for everything that you've done and continue to do.
Have you met the guys I served with?
Yes.
I consider myself lucky when people thank me. I'm like, you have no idea. But thank you. I appreciate it. All right, guys. This has been another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. Remember, go to Apple Podcasts, whatever your streaming platform is, Spotify, leave a review. We actually read them. That's how we get better. So hopefully it's a 5-star. But even if it's not, please leave a constructive and professional comment. We'll read it. All right, guys. Out of here.